Warning, the following podcast contains spoilers and swears. Hi, who are you?
Hi, I'm Evelyn Rogers. Who are you?
I'm your dad, Scott Rogers. What are we doing here?
Podcast. It's called Filler and Father, where we talk about the magicians and magicians-related things.
And today we're talking about magicians-related things.
Yeah, today we are talking about the second book in the Magicians trilogy by Lev Grossman, The Magician King.
Yay, I finally finished a book.
Published in... I have the book here.
2000 and you should have had this ready to go.
And 11.
2011, that was just 10 years ago.
Jesus Christ. Oh, God.
What were you doing 10 years ago?
10 years ago? I was in fifth grade.
You're in fifth grade. What was fifth grade like?
It was a thing. I was getting in trouble.
You were getting in trouble.
I was getting sent to the principal's office monthly.
Yes, you were getting in trouble. You're nothing but trouble. Thank 2011 you. Was when I started working for Imagineering.
Good for you.
And now I'm not working for Imagineering.
Good for you.
Oh, that's sad. All right. Speaking of sad, let's talk about The Magician's King. The most sad
the
book
Magician
in the...
King.
Oh, the
Magician. No
it's not The Magician's Kings?
The Magician King.
The Magician's Kings.
There's no S.
The Kings of the Magician.
No.
Yes, we're reading The Magician King by Lev Grossman, our friend. Hi, Lev. All right. So... My review?
Yeah.
It was sad. The end.
End of podcast.
End of podcast.
We're
I'm done talking
done.
About it.
That's it?
That's it. That's all I have to say. No, I also have to say that the cover of this edition is bad. I'm sorry. Penguin Books has a terrible cover. At the very least, you should add a door with seven keyholes in it. If you wanted like a non-person cover, but if you want to see an awesome idea for a cover... You should see the drawing I made.
Yeah, Dad drew magician's fan art.
I did. I drew one piece of magician's fan art, and that was a cool scene that happens about halfway through the book.
Yeah, because
I think that the magicians could benefit by having awesome 80s style
romance
fantasy.
Novel
no,
painted,
not romance
oil
novel.
Oil painted.
Yeah, like Hildebrand brother, Frank Frazetta style.
The oiled chest, and you've got a buxom maiden going, you know, swooning a little. In his arms.
A little swoon.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with a little swoon. Nothing wrong with a giant sword and purple magic crackly energy. That would see if I saw that on the cover of The Magician King, I'd say, I need to read this book.
I think it would be.
But instead, what do I get? I get
a
big
cave
with an eclipse.
Yeah.
And nowhere in the book is there a cave.
Yep.
And then barely do they even mention the eclipse they mentioned in the first book.
They do a little bit.
No.
It's more in the third. They talk about it.
More in the third book?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have opinions about the book covers. I think that the first and second ones, I like them because it's coherent and it's the same kind of theme. You have a tree on the first book and then you have a couple tiny trees on the third book. But in this one, it breaks the pattern,
There's
but
no
not
tree.
In like a fun way. Like, because like the also the color scheme of the first and third U.S. paperback editions is it's like this dark, kind of dark root branches and like trunk kind of thing for the tree, and then you have like this kind of really nice minty kind of vivid green, and then you have like the misty fog background, and it's the same thing for the Magician's Land. But then the second one, it's like dark, which could be cool, but then you don't really truly have that other like the minty green and stuff.
Well, wait a second though, so this is the paperback edition.
This is the paperback.
What I'm going to look for
so
is the
here,
hardback
well,
edition.
Let me do that's
Let's
not
see.
That
no,
that's the wrong book
that's
Daddy.
The wrong book
It's it looks the same, I'm pretty sure.
As in the hardback?
Yeah. It's the same.
Yep.
But I will say that the TV tie-in covers are pretty cool.
It's better.
Yeah, on the first book you have Quentin with a book open and it's like cool magic stuff. And then
what the hell is that?
He's looking at another version of the cover.
It just has Lev's name on it. That's it. It
and
says The Magician King, a novel.
And then
maybe that's a release, like a pre-release version.
And then the second one has a picture of Julia doing like cool magic on it. And then the third book is Alice doing cool magic on it. But the TV tie-in edition of The Magician's Land paperback only exists in Polish.
All right, so here's another. Here's a good one. This is The Magician King.
Looks like a tree.
Looks like a tree.
With keys on
it. It's got keys, and it's got a clock in it. That's a great cover.
That's awesome.
I mean, it's not as cool as Quentin with a magic sword, but but it's much better cover.
This is the hardback, it says.
Oh, so maybe it's the original cover of it, maybe?
Maybe. No, I don't think so.
I don't know. Well, that's a much better cover, so Penguin, get your shit together.
Republish, reprint.
Yes, I can recommend a really good artist too to do it. That's me because I drew that picture. It's awesome. All right, let's talk about what's in the book. I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. It's been so long. I remember from kind of the middle to the end, but
I just finished.
Yeah, but it was a long time ago. So let's look at the beginning.
Okay,
what happens?
Well,
I'm sure you have it all memorized.
Yeah. Well, I thought we weren't going to summarize the plot when we did.
Let's talk a little bit about the plot.
Okay. Well, essentially,
or should I say, what's my favorite parts?
Okay. Well, I will just tell like the kind
Let's
of
Let's summarize it because we have spoilers on this.
We do have
episode.
Spoilers. So in The Magician King, Quentin is king of Fillory. He's been ruling now for about 2 years and he's getting kind of disillusioned and bored. He didn't realize how boring it would be to rule a fantasy kingdom. And so at the beginning of the book,
They're hunting a hare.
It's like in Narnia when they're hunting the white stag. And he comes across this giant clock tree that's like wiggling and turning and stuff, and
he's like,
"Oh my god, it's totally like a quest, you know? I should totally do this." And then they're like, "Well, why would you uproot your life to like do this? You've gotten your happy ending." So he kind of talks himself out of going on the quest. And then he's like, "Well, okay, what else do we have to do? Give me something to do because I still feel restless." So he's like, "Fine, I'm gonna go like collect taxes.
I'm gonna get on a boat and I'm gonna sail to the edge of the world, world."
No. He's gonna go collect taxes.
After Ireland. Yeah, but After Ireland's at the edge of the map of Fillory.
It's at the edge of Fillory.
It's
the
like
edge of their
the
territory.
The furthest they know about the world because this world is terribly unmapped.
Yeah. Well, there's a map though.
Well, but it's only to a certain point.
Yes.
They don't have it all mapped out.
But then to prepare for this because he wants to feel all kingly, he hosts like a tournament competition to have his personal bodyguard. Thus we get Bingle.
Yeah.
Best
awesome.
Character.
Yeah, Bingle.
Awesome swordsman. He's so great. And he also refits and gets the Muntjac, which is the ship. Sails on.
With a clockwork heart.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And then there's Benedict, who is the
royal map maker. He's one of the Fenwicks, which is one of the like the royal families in The Magicians.
So he's like a courtier.
He's related,
courtier? What's the word when somebody hangs out at the court?
No, well, he's just the map maker.
Cartesian.
He's the map
courtesan.
He's the map maker.
Yeah, he's a map maker.
And
he's a mopey
Quentin sees
high schooler.
Quentin sees himself in Benedict, so he has him come along. And then they go on their quest for taxes.
First they go to an island, and it's a lovely tropical island.
Yeah.
And they meet Elaine, who is like
This is where they are going to collect taxes.
Right.
So he meets Elaine, who is the customs person.
Customs agent.
For the island. There's no one else there except for Elaine and her daughter, Eleanor.
No, I thought there were other people there. No, there were other people there.
They're like in town,
but
they
just
don't,
people.
They just like don't.
They're not. They don't really
interact.
Get mentioned, but there's townspeople that are there, and it's friendly. Like Quentin goes, and everybody's friendly. And he's like, oh, this isn't much of an adventure.
Yeah.
And then the little girl, Eleanor.
She gives Quentin a passport that says King Quentin.
King Quentin.
K's backwards.
Yes, But
Quentin has a very interesting conversation with Elaine, who she's asked him again, just like Benedict asks Quentin if he's going on the quest. She asks Quentin if he's going on a quest, and you know, they have this like really deep conversation, and and the next morning she's gone. Leaving Eleanor, her little 5-year-old, behind.
And Quentin is very upset about that.
Yeah, he's like, I need to start Fillorian Social Services, which I agree, he should.
Yes,
I love whenever the book talks about Quentin having paternal tendencies, I'm like, yes!
No, I always think it's funny that he's like, I'm going to start these different government agencies.
And then he doesn't.
And then he doesn't. And then they end up invariably... they find a key, but there's several... There's a whole second plot that's going on in parallel. It skips every other chapter, and that is what happened to Julia. because in the book we see Julia, and she doesn't get accepted into Breakbills, and then we see her later in the first book where she's kind of strung out like a junkie, and then that's, and then at the end we see her with like superpowers hanging out with Elliot and Janet.
Yeah,
Janet, I mean, who really doesn't get much of anything to do in this second book.
Don't worry.
Poor Janet.
Poor Janet.
Is the whole third book about Janet?
No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
But
maybe the fourth
book.
Yeah,
so Janet's story. Actually, that was actually the first question I had for you, is what did you think about Quentin and Julia and having this like dual perspective? It's not just Quentin anymore. Now it's split, so you get to not only see, you know, Julia through Quentin's eyes, but now you get to see Quentin through Julia's eyes, and
well,
vice versa.
I thought it was interesting. I almost kind of wish, though, that we had seen more from Julia's perspective in the first book, because she's like, you know, one of the three first characters you meet in the book, and then to have her kind of unceremoniously dropped in the first book, I kind of felt like, I mean, it was great, she was getting her due, but I kind of wish that some of that had been in the first book, just because, I don't know. It was, I mean, I the format is fine. I have no, although it's the chapter headings have no indication. Like, if you read a Stephen King novel, Stephen King will do that as well. So I have no problem with that writing conceit. But Stephen King at least will, like, you know, say the name of the character at the chapter heading or something. So at least you know, like, whose perspective it's from, which I appreciate. Stephen King, good job.
I believe we should bring back table of contents in books.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I would like to be able to find chapters when I
read
a book.
Yeah, that's nice, too. But anyway, so I the formatting was cool. Mm-hmm. I didn't mind it. You know, it's something I'm used to. It was good to see Julia's perspective, but the thing was, because I've already seen the TV show, I already knew kind of where her story was headed. And so I, you know, it's kind of like watching a car crash in slow motion,
uh-huh.
Right? You're like, you knew it's coming. You see all these new characters.
Also in the book at the beginning and stuff, you know, Quentin and Elliot are talking at one point, and Elliot's like, hey, just so you know, like, Julia's kind of like, there's something up with Julia, and like, you should keep an eye on her and like, take, you know, be there for her as her friend. And Quentin's like, oh, it can't be that bad.
Yeah, no, it is. Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, Julia's story is like,
it's
unpleasant,
incredibly tragic.
Well, it's it ends in tragedy, and along the way there's definitely moments. Like, there's a couple of moments in Julia's story where her story parallels Quentin's, which is interesting. And I think if Quentin had known more about it, he would have been more empathetic towards her.
Yeah, but also Quentin's, like, kind of a low-key narcissist.
Well, he's not low-key at all. He's very much self-absorbed.
Yeah, which is why I think the first book is all his perspective.
Right,
That's why Julia drops off the face of the earth, because she's not,
it's not part of his story.
Yeah. But
you can never escape people in your life.
Yeah.
Like, the person that you are the least looking forward to seeing again, you will probably see again. Well, right? Like, the people that you love and like, oh, I really...
Well, he loves Julia, though.
No, but I'm saying in your life.
Oh, my life.
Think about the person that you never want to see again in your life, and I guarantee you they will show up again.
I already have proof of that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Look at that. Not even 20 years old and already have horrible life stories.
Oh, I've got many.
All right. But this isn't about your life story.
No,
this is about Julia and Quentin.
This is the Magician's Podcast.
So, yes, Quentin, he...
But the townspeople, they're like, oh, yeah, you're looking for the golden key, right? Because he finishes the tax stuff. And, like, Elaine's gone, but, you know, someone in the village will take care of
Eleanor. And he gets this fairy tale, which...
Well, no, first they're just like...
Well, there's
go get the key. They don't even tell him the story of it. He doesn't find out until later.
Well, that's stupid.
They're
because
just like, go get the key. It's down the road. And he's like, this can't be it. This is so easy.
Yeah, I know. A lot of it was easy.
I know. And then he goes with Julia, because Julia came along with the tax purposes because, you know, they want her to do something. And she's, you know, depressed and also awesome and cool and goth. And she's got black eyes and long braids and wears all black.
She's kind of silvery skinned.
Awesome. But they go and they find the key, and Quentin gets the key, and he like just starts fucking around with it, and he finds like a door in the air.
Right.
And he opens it, and they're like, oh, are you sure you should go through that? And he's like, let's go! And so Julia and Quentin go through the door, and they end up in They back end on up Earth. On Earth.
Yeah.
And it's been like 2 years since they've been on Earth.
Right.
And now, and then for 3 days, Quentin and Julia.
But here's the thing.
Quest, they basically go all over the U.S. and later to like Italy.
Well, they portal all over the place and you get to learn
more. Try and get back to Villery.
You get to learn more about kind of the underground part of magic. Yeah, the
and
hedge
it's really
witches.
Cool. I really love the kind of structure of the safe houses in the book and how there's, it's not just like a leveling system. Like, yes, there is, but also you can, once you know the basics, you can come in and practice.
Yeah, the hedge witches have like tattoos to show their rank.
Yeah,
and then
that's
they
in
have,
the show as well.
Yeah, I know. And then they have to prove to each other that they know. So there's kind of a whole series. It's almost like katas, like your mom used to do for...
Katas is for karate. Oh. And that's for that what I
what
and
you
Jack
did. Well,
used
what's,
to do.
But what did, no, your mom did...
Mom did Tai Chi,
and
different.
There's katas for that,
are
right?
There?
Yeah, yeah. It's the 130-something, right? Like, she's got 130 poses that she has to go through, and that's a kata. But I thought that was interesting that the, poor Julia, though, she was always having to prove herself as a magician over and over again. Pain in the ass. The other thing that I thought was interesting was that each of the hedge witches' houses had these books that had like all the spells that they know. Yeah, they're all books of their shared knowledge, which I thought was cool. But there's a moment where Julia has gotten so powerful that she will look at a spellbinder and go, "Ugh, I know all this. Yeah, whatever," and just bail. And that I thought was an interesting and actually kind of a funny. I felt. I related to that idea because...
Dadkins, Julia.
Well, I related to that idea because, like, if I do a lot of research on topics and there's certain points where you do know a lot about a topic and you're just like, all right, this is no help for me. I'm going to move on and try and find... And so you're constantly digging for these little nuggets of information because that's where the value... The things that you don't know, you're trying to learn. So I totally empathized with Julia and her quest for knowledge.
My favorite thing about hedges in the books is that they're all ages, and that's something I don't think the show really like shows, is that like Quentin goes with Julia to these different safe houses because they're trying to find a portal that'll get them back to Fillory, or they get a button. They're trying to get a button back to Fillory because they, you know, they had extra ones. There were 5 for each of the Chatwins or whatever. So Quentin observes when they're at the safe houses that there's like some people who are as young as like 11 and there are people that are much older and everyone's from different economic backgrounds, but they're all there studying and learning magic for the first time and trying their best.
That's because in a book you don't have to pay for a teacher on set.
You don't need a teacher on set. You could just have like a little kid also there.
No, even if a little kid is also there in a TV show, you have to have a teacher on set, and they can only work for certain hours.
I'm aware.
I know, it's a pain in the ass. So kids suck. So Julia's on this quest to improve, and she comes across this group of... Well, she quits magic first,
she
right?
She quits magic, and she tries to go cold turkey.
Yeah, and it's not good.
Because
she ends up a mess.
Yeah, she ends up a mess. Because magic,
and that's when
magic finds her again. Basically,
well, that's why when Quentin found her, right? Wasn't she?
No. So she tries to do. You're looking away from me. So she tries to do magic, and she finds leads, and she does all these She finally gets the like rainbow finger spell.
Right.
That's when she like shows it to Quentin. And he's like, can't help you. Wah, wah. I'm dating Alice now. I don't love you anymore. My feelings are kind of shallow. And then Julia feels like at a loss because he was like, there's like proof that there's break bills for her, but there's like no way to get access to it. So then she decides, cold turkey, I'm going to focus on applying to college because I skipped a year. I'm going to work. I'm going to save up money. You know, I'm going to do all this stuff and it'll be fine. And she joins Free Trader Beowulf, which is like an online forum for a bunch of depressed smart people.
Yeah, it's essentially Mensa for magicians, we learn.
Well,
but
Julia doesn't know that. She just, you know,
she just thinks
they're
a bunch of like-minded nerds.
Yeah, and then eventually...
By the way, I want to brag a little bit.
Okay,
is that
you got the reference.
That I got the reference. I knew, Lev, I see you. I know that you're a Traveler player, role-playing game player. That's what the reference is from. It's from an adventure from the game Travelers. Free Trader Beowulf is a ship that's in trouble that you have to go help.
Yep.
So,
but,
there you go.
Julia eventually...
Oh, wait a second. Let's stop the synopsis for a second. Okay. And let's talk about that Lev's nerd references are very on point in this in this book. There's a lot of good ones. I appreciated them. They run the gamut.
What was your favorite?
Oh, gosh. I forget what my favorite one was. There was one in particular that made me laugh, and I don't remember what it was.
It was funny.
It was funny. It was good. It was a good nerd reference, but... I don't remember which one it was, but there were a lot of them, and that's what I like about Lev is that he's not. It's not like Ready Player One, which is like
I don't like that. Well, have you read the book? I've read excerpts of it.
No, you should read the book. But
I don't want to.
But the Lev's is not like trying to prove that he's a nerd, like the guy who wrote Ready Player One is. Like, the guy, Ready Player One, is, like, kind of thirsty for your approval that he's a nerd. Where Lev is just like, yeah, I'm a nerd, and that's really the way I relate to things in the world. So that's the analogy I'm going to use. So as a fellow nerd who doesn't like to show off too much, I appreciate it.
You like to show off a lot.
My nerd knowledge?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't at all do. You guys have no idea.
I...
My nerd power is so high, and you guys have never seen me even...
I do that on purpose. I avoid that on purpose. Instead, you get subjected to me or dumping all the time.
Baiting me with your nerddom. How many times have I had to sit through your magician's
You mean my
nerddom?
Silmarillion lecture I yes. gave you yesterday?
Yes, that was very informative. All right, so I appreciated that.
Yeah.
All right, so then...
But Julia magic finds her again, because she's like, oh... Because in Free Trade of Beowulf, they do this thing where they find patterns for, like, fun, and they try to solve equations. So Julia, she's walking along the street, and she realizes that the buildings have a sort of pattern, and so she keeps following them. And she's like, wow, it's so weird how it's, like, a repeating sequence, and she keeps following and following.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Until she finds the hedge...
That's kind of like...
A hedge safe house.
That kind of reminds me of when I was in college and I took a watercolor class.
Oh.
And we started looking, like the teacher was saying, you got to stop looking at the object and you have to start looking at the light, because that's how you paint watercolor, is more by the light than by the object. And so after I took that class, it definitely changed my perception of the world, where I started to look at things differently based on the light rather than the object itself. And I thought that was interesting, because that was a neat metaphor. You know, this idea that Julia could see the pattern behind things and hadn't seen it before, and all of a sudden it's kind of like if you start looking for faces in houses, like in buildings, you start seeing faces everywhere.
Like they mentioned this one time on the Fic List podcast, but if you look for like a Wizard of Oz reference, you will start finding Wizard of Oz references.
Yeah, they're
just
everywhere.
Like if you look for red cars, you'll start finding red cars.
Exactly. Or the, you know, if you see an ape playing basketball, you'll see the ape playing basketball. Otherwise, you'll just completely miss it. Have you ever seen that video?
No.
You've never seen that video of the ape playing basketball?
No.
Really?
Why?
Oh, okay. Maybe I'll show that to you.
But back in Quentin's perspective, they're cross country looking for portals and going around trying to find leads about the button to Fillory. And we get a little bit more glimpse into Julia's past, where like she has history with you know, some of the people who are teachers at the safe houses. There's this one dryad or something named Warren, who she's like had a pass with.
She
did anything to get information,
right,
would sleep with people and stuff, because all she cared was the magic.
I think that this guy Warren is like, do you know who the Floronic Man is? Oh, look at that face. I must increase your knowledge. here we go. I'm going to show off a little. Floronic Man is a old DC villain, was the villain of the Atom, and then eventually became a Swamp Thing villain.
Mm.
But he was like essentially a dryad who was passing as human, mm-hmm. and essentially was wearing like a rubber mask, and underneath he looked like kind of a wood guy. And that's what Warren reminded me of, is he was like some sort of fey, you know, wood creature that was like trying to pass. But then when Julia showed up, either she was so chock full of magic or he was getting agitated about seeing her that he like kind of lost his cool, and he would start erupting branches out of him. And
it's
I thought
like,
that was
what
interesting.
You did to me.
But what I love is that they never, like, once again, it just doesn't get, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
That's what I like. Again, it's one of the things that I like about the writing, is that there's these moments where there are these really interesting little magical things that happen. Or there's even like details about the magic that you don't like when Julia was making, she has her moment where she kind of like finds magic. She creates does a spell where she can create rainbows.
And it creates light. Fingers trail lights.
Trail light. But what was really cool about it wasn't just that, was that afterwards her fingers were stained.
Yeah, and would smudge.
Would like cause, like it was almost like her fingers were pastels.
Yeah.
And they would leave traces of color afterwards. And that was that was such a great detail that like you think about it and you go, yeah, you know, anything lasting in the real world would have some sort of it, you know, magic doesn't just come and go and that's it. Sometimes there's lasting effects. And that's one thing that I really appreciated about, like, there was a couple moments like that in the story that show kind of the permanence of magic rather than it being just ethereal.
Yeah, it's good. And then Quentin goes to, they get to Italy because they've found out that there's like someone there who's like related in the hedge circle.
Yeah, this major magician
who can like give them information.
And so they go through this whole rigmarole with bowl.
No, listen, but one of my favorite things about that bit before they see him is that Quentin is looking around Italy and he has this moment where he's like, wow, Italy looks kind of a lot like Fillory. Like it reminds me of Fillory. Venice. And
you know where else Venice looks like?
Venice.
Naboo from Star Wars.
But I'm not done.
Our sponsor this week is Star Wars.
Talking about
the movie
thing.
Star Wars. Why? We love Star Wars.
Oh my god.
Yeah, thank you for sponsoring us this week, Star Wars, for inspiring us and teaching us to live and love and learn.
Live, laugh, and love
through your wonderful shows like The Mandalorian.
Okay, you're done.
And that other thing just came out that I haven't read yet.
No more.
What's that one? That old Jedi, the woke Jedi series coming out?
No more.
What is that called?
No more.
The New Republic? High Republic?
No more.
All right. Thank you, Star Wars. We love you.
No more.
All right, that was our sponsor for this week, Star Wars. Ugh. Just the concept of Star Wars.
Stop.
All right, anyway.
But my favorite part of that scene is that Quentin is looking around Venice, and he's seeing these, like, echoes of Fillory.
Right.
And he kind of...
he's like, I could live here.
No, he says, like, he didn't realize, like, how magical and intriguing Earth was, and, like, quote, the real world. And I just really like that part because he's like starting to realize that maybe, you know, he still wants to live in Fillory, but he's like, maybe my life isn't confined to this one place that I've always wanted to go to and I've lived in for 2 years.
Which, of course, 12 chapters later, he completely forgets about.
I know.
That's
because it was a high stress situation.
I know. So here's an interesting thing about that because I did like that bit also, which is, wouldn't it be nice in the world, like in your life, if you just knew, if you were like a homing pigeon or a sparrow swallow. What's the one that go back to Capistrano? Is it a swallow? It's not Monty Python reference. A coconut swallow. What if like everybody in their heart of hearts knew where they'd be most at home?
That would be cool.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
That would be sweet.
That would be a nice thing. Well, if we know, because sometimes I feel like I don't know, you know, am I supposed to be here? Am I supposed to, you know, there's other cities I've been to and I'm like, yeah, it's pretty cool. I could live in London. I could live in Tokyo, you know, but I don't know if I've ever felt like completely home. I'd say the only place I've really felt completely at home.
Is in their home?
No, it's Disneyland.
Okay, weirdo.
What? Why is that weirdo?
Weird.
It's not weird.
But
a lot of other people feel
like, magically hazed, basically.
Yeah,
they
get tormented. Yeah, so the Wizard of Oz character, is Josh. He's
who
fucking
we
with
haven't
them.
Seen.
Yeah.
He was gone at the end of the first book. He left to go travel to other worlds and The Teletubbies are real. I love that. That's my favorite. That's so good.
He gave away the punchline. You could have built up to it. You could have said he went to all these other worlds.
So good,
and he was like, most of them are like Ice Planet or Desert Planet or...
Well, he didn't explore their biomes, though.
No, we talked a little bit about...
one section.
And then he was like, dude, Teletubbies, they're totally real.
Well, my
so you know what that means, though?
Well, my favorite is that Josh went initially to go look for Middle Earth, which is exactly what I would do.
Yeah, I know. But, all right, so here's...
Even says Eru Iluvatar, which made me so happy.
All right, so here's the question.
Yes. Also, he like fucked a siren, like a banshee.
Bird person. Yeah.
He fucked like a banshee.
Yes.
Like.
All right. So, well, it's Josh. So let me ask you: if Teletubbies are real, does that mean that the baby sun is
real? Absolutely.
Oh my god, that's the terrifying thing.
Absolutely.
Teletubbies are just weird, but the baby sun is horrifying.
Yeah.
All right, so he's back on Earth.
He's back on Earth,
had the button that allowed him to travel through the world.
But he sold it to the canal dragon.
To a
dragon. Because he wanted, and he has, a giant palazzo.
Well, the dragon's
awesome
essentially,
house.
No, the dragon gave him like $100 million. And then he bought a house in Venice, and he was and he's just living the high life.
Yeah, and he's giving information to Hedges and stuff because... It's a lot of untapped potential.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really cool, actually, to see, like, someone from Break Bills bridging that divide.
Right.
Which is, again, something you don't really get to see.
Well, it's a class system, right?
Yeah.
It's a snobbery. The Break Bills are like the Ivy League school, like
we've
talked about.
They're not even that good compared to other magic schools.
Well, they got a lot of Title IX problems.
They do.
But,
so many.
But the Hedge Witches are like these scrappy little, you know, people trying to find... magic in the midst of, you know, reality.
Oh, we should mention that they do go to Break Bills before they go to, Italy because they try to go find, like, someone they can talk to. Because Quentin's like, maybe Penny, if he lived, you know, because Quentin doesn't know what happened to Penny. And he brings Julia with him to Break Bills. And that's, like, the first time she's been on campus since she got tested. There's that whole... He, like, talks to Dean Fogg, who's an asshole and unhelpful.
Well, just unhelpful. He's not an asshole.
He is.
Nah, he's just not helpful. This version of Dean Fogg is like, he's definitely mad at Julia for breaking the memory spell. Like, you can tell he's kind of pissed off that...
He's just more, I think like you said, it's a classist thing where it's like, why are you bringing a Hedge on campus?
Right,
he doesn't know who she is, really. Like, well, Quentin told him about Julia, like, his first year, but then, like, other than that, like, they didn't do anything about it.
Right. But Fogg in the books is not as big an asshole as the one in the TV show. The one in the TV show is pretty bad.
He does kind of suck, though, in the books.
Well, he does suck more in this book. He was much better in the first book.
But, yeah, they go to Italy, and they find Josh, and we also get to meet Poppy, who is so awesome. She's
Poppy,
Australian.
Poppy, who's like completely...
Directly, straightforward.
Completely
and
not at all in the TV show in any
form. Yes, she
is. Who? When?
She shows up in season 3 and season 4.
When does Poppy show up in season 3?
Episode 6.
Like for one episode?
She's in 2 episodes. She shows up in episode 6, The Abyss. And she
what's her face? Felicia Day?
Yes, Daddy.
Oh, right.
It's completely different. She's
American.
See,
I
really like Poppy in the books. She's
really
Poppy
direct in the books
and straightforward, and like she's got gumption. I love it.
Well, she's also very kind of straightforward and factual.
That's what I said.
And yes, I know nobody's saying you didn't, but she's also kind of this voice of reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Quentin is all emotion. Josh is like, hey man, whatever feels good. Julia is like right now speaking without contractions, so she's like this weird robot person in a way, you know, like
she's in her whole other...
Yeah, she's in her own jam.
Yeah.
Although I do like how they resolve that at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was great. Where she ascends. Well, it was a spoiler.
Ascends.
Yeah, she ascends.
We have spoilers.
Yeah, I know. She, Julia at the end, she gets touched by this goddess that the whole, or like a big part of it, they're trying to reach.
Yeah.
And she makes connection with the goddess. And then, like, at the end, it kind of fulfills her, and she evolves into kind of a demigod. But
she is a demigod.
Well, yeah. But the best part about it is that her contractions come back. Is that because I noticed that in the book too? I was reading. I'm like, wait, there's a contraction.
Yeah.
What the heck?
It's good.
Yeah, it is good. It's a nice bit. Once again, there's nice bits of writing, like little. They're not quite gags, but they, you know, like in the sense or gimmicks, you know. but they work. Like it's just the reading experience. If the ending of the book wasn't so damn sad, the reading of the experience of this was good. The only time during the book that I got a little tired of was the free trader Beowulf stuff, because
Dad just hates when people talk.
No, it was a little too much. Like, there was a little too much. It dragged on. There were fun little moments where they were like talking to leprechauns and talking to, you know, they were trying to find information about.
Our Lady Underground.
Right, right. So this group of like super nerd magicians.
Julie gets magically hazed she
that wasn't cool.
Gets accepted after she goes through like this whole process where she has to prove she knows like every spell you can possibly master in order without fucking up once.
Right.
She does it over and over again after she gets basically scouted by them. She goes to France. And
they're all hanging out in France.
In this mansion.
Yep.
kind of culty.
Yeah, very culty.
And so she finally proves herself, and then like, you've finally done it. There's no more levels, but now you can mix and match stuff.
Right.
And
make your own magic.
Yeah, make your own magic. And what we're trying to do is find something even higher than the next level of, I think it's like 250 or something. I don't know. I'm currently rereading the first book, not the second. But you know, they're like, okay, well, what do you want to do? Because we've been trying to essentially, like, get contact with the gods. And
they've kind of narrowed it down. They said France, this part of France, has, like, been the epicenter of Western culture. And all the god worshipping has been happening in this area. And so they're trying to find some sort of clue to which god they can easily contact that will then... You know, that is also benevolent.
Mm-hmm.
That will help them out.
Yeah,
See if there's anything beyond, because they've tried all these other...
And there's local creatures and gods, like, they're like, oh yeah, there's like a Reynard the Fox, whatever, he's like...
He's a trickster god.
He's a little trickster god, and they're like, oh, there's
But there's
other
also
people.
Supernatural creatures. They meet this weird, like, they call him Bowser from Super... That was one of the ones I laughed at, was Bowser from Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Like, this very sad... He reminds me of the,
Like a kappa?
No, he reminds me of the sad, what's the creature in Alice in Wonderland? That's like the cow dragon. And he's like, cries, tears. Little story. Yeah, I forget who it is too. But anyway, like, it's this very miserable little mythological creature. And
he's great.
It's fun. He's only a few pages worth of conversation with him, but there's lots of interesting bits, like as they're kind of scouring through all the trying to find a lead, right? Like, they're doing detective work, but it did wear on a bit long. I was near the end of it, I'm like, okay, come on, you know, get to the point.
Well, it gets a little exciting at the end.
Yeah, then the point gets horrible.
Yeah.
So they end up they're trying to contact this
Our Lady Underground.
Yeah, the Black Madonna, which is an actual character from mythology, and if you know art, like, you'll know this character.
Yeah.
And they try to summon her, but instead, Asmo,
and they start getting like signs that they're onto something.
Right. There's a lot. Yeah.
Asmodeus is awesome.
One of the characters.
She's great.
The free trader Beowulf characters.
Yeah. She and Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Right. Pouncy Silver Kitten and what's the other one? The cyber or something.
I have the book.
Yeah. There's five or six of these kind of super smart magicians. They've tried like all these different ways. They're like, we've looked at it from a physics perspective. We looked at it from a theological perspective. We looked at it from a quantum mechanics perspective. They're like super
methodical.
Yeah, methodical about every single way that magic can be done and how to access it.
Yeah.
And what's the power powering magic? Yeah. That's what they're trying to find out.
And what happens is they start getting signs that like there is a larger power, yeah, and they start experiencing essentially miracles.
Yeah.
And so Asmodeus is like, yeah, like I totally, you know, I had like scars that got healed that no one knows about but me.
And then like they put their hands out into the moonlight and coins would appear
down.
Yeah, or
it's
milk
and stuff. It's so cool. And so they keep, you know, following the rabbit trail and stuff. And then they're like, okay, we're going to try and do a summoning. Like, for real, we met this person who has given us information about how to summon OLU, and they're getting ready for it, and everyone's like, they've gotten so focused that they've like stopped really eating. They've all started intermittently fasting, basically, and like wearing simple clothes, and you know, not.
Yeah, they're getting obsessed.
Yeah, they're getting very obsessed. And Julia, kind of this whole moment, she's like, I've been trying to find this place where I want to belong, and what happens? She has the realization while they're summoning OLU that she's found her people and she's found that place.
Yeah,
and then.
But then all of a sudden she's like, I want
to. You know, I don't want to do this. I don't want to change anything.
Yeah, I don't want to lose my friends. I don't want to lose this situation
like poor,
I'm in.
Like poor Pouncey, he really wants it because he just wants to like die.
Yeah, it's terrible. They're all broken.
They're
people.
Like, we want to be healed, or you know, we want power, or we just want to be at peace. And right. Julia realizes she doesn't want any of that. She doesn't want power. She just wants people. She wants family. They've been tricked by the trickster god Reynard. So this is trigger warning now for, we're going to talk probably about rape a little bit and sexual assault.
Yeah, it's a very graphic.
It's a very picture. Graphic scene, but Reynard the fox, he also, his character just, he's like so fucking cool though.
Like a 12-foot-tall fox.
Yeah, wearing a cool wee little French outfit, little waistcoat and stuff, and he's got a fox head. It's awesome. But he's awful. He like eats the heart of one character. You know, he breaks the neck of another, crushes people against the door. They're locked inside. He like gets rid of like their ability to leave, and he
terrorizes them
and violently murdering them until it's only like three people left. It's like Pouncey and Julia and Asmo. And Pouncey gets like, he tries to attack, I think, and he gets thrown against the door, and he like, it's bad. He's bleeding, and it's awful. And he's like, take me, kill me because you came here for something. And we wanted stuff, but you can't give it to us. Like,
and Reynard's like, hey, you're dying. You have nothing to give me.
And then he dies.
And well, no, first he goes, take me. And he's like, hey, you're dying. It's a moot point. And then he threatens Joy some more. And then Pouncey goes, no, take me. And he goes, no, you're almost dead. And then he goes, all right, now you're dead.
Yeah, I love that part. It's so ominous.
It's terrible. And
he's so nonchalant because it's just normal for him.
Yeah. Right.
But what happens is Julia's like, okay, well, let Asmo go.
Now, wait. Here's a thing that was never clarified. Does she get away?
I shan't say.
Ugh, you're the worst. I thought you said no spoilers.
Well, you haven't read the third book, so I won't spoil that for you. All right,
that implies that they're in the third book then.
But Asmo, but Julia offers herself essentially to Reynard, and there's a very graphic rape scene that happens.
Yeah,
and
it's more graphic than it needed to be.
Yeah,
it's disturbing.
It's very disturbing, yeah. And what happens is that Julia gets raped, and in the process of like pulling out, Reynard takes her shade.
Yeah,
rips her soul out, and it's. You know, it is I do think it's a very interesting and empowering story about moving on from sexual trauma and how to take your own agency back.
Yeah.
But I do think that level of, like, graphic description of what actually happened it was a little too much for the story. And, you know, Lev has said in interviews that he would, if he could go back and rewrite stuff, that would be like an aspect that he would change because it's so graphic. And I do also personally, I think that just Julia having the violent death of her friends probably would have been enough. And then it would have been like some other way that her shade could have gotten taken. Like,
I mean, they could have just said that he could have gone into it without the description. And then afterwards, you know,
a little ellipses kind of thing, yeah, or something.
Something, right.
Yeah, but it's a very violent and graphic scene, and it's upsetting.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that it's alluded over the course of the story that Julia doesn't have a shade.
Yeah.
It's kind of, I forget where it happens.
The thing is, at the very beginning of the story, Elliot, when he's talking to Quentin and telling Quentin that like something's up with Julia, he describes, he's like, oh, I never told you how we met, and it was Janet and I were at a spa in Hollywood or some Beverly Hills or something, and we were relaxing because we were so traumatized from what happened in Fillory, and Julia was there trying to relax and also trying to essentially get something back, and he was like, yeah, whatever she was trying to do, it didn't work.
Yeah.
And you know, it's this whole time, like, we hear about how, you know, there's something up with Juliet, like, she's not having normal reactions to stuff, and she's kind of, like, she's less feeling and stuff.
Yeah, later in the story, they end up going to the underworld, and none of the shades in the underworld can see her, and that's because she's a ghost.
She's a reverse ghost.
Yeah, she's a ghost to them. Yeah, which I thought was interesting.
I love that bit.
All right, so are we at my? We're a little past.
We'll shift gears back to Quentin.
Right.
So basically, we
get to my favorite part.
So Quentin and Josh and Poppy and Julia are like, okay, we got to figure this out. So Quentin goes to talk to the canal dragon.
All right.
And the dragon's like, you have to go on a quest, and you're going to have to do what a hero does on a quest, which is, like, lose stuff. And Quentin's like, oh, but, like, can you give me the button back? And they're like, nah.
Nah, you got to go get another one.
And so they're like, damn. He comes out of the water, and he's like, fuck, okay.
He says you have to go to the first door.
Yeah, first door. And so they think about it, and, like, the first door, Teferi was in the Chatwin's house. It was the clock that they went through.
Right, so we got to go to their house.
So they go to Cornwall, and...
And again, Quentin is like, this is a really nice place.
Yeah, he's like, wow, I could live here. Yeah. He's like, wow, maybe Earth isn't as bad as I thought it was when I was 17.
Essentially, it's... I think this is very true because I experienced a little bit of this myself. And that is, as an American going to Europe, you go, wow, Europe is really nice. And it's not any better or worse, I guess, than some places in the U.S.
Some places in Europe are better than the U.S.
Yeah, like when you went there, you went to Luxembourg and you were like, oh, or where was it that you went? And was it Switzerland?
That was one of the places.
You were like, oh, I could live there.
I went to France. And then we went to...
Was Nice nice?
We didn't go to Nice. France, Switzerland.
Anyway, you went to Europe. And when you came back,
Germany.
You were like, I could live in Europe.
They had doors that went all the way to the ground for the bathroom. That was the best part.
All right, well, maybe you'll go back someday. Maybe we'll all get to travel again. We'll all get to travel back. I'd like to go to France.
I like France. It's very nice there.
All right. Anyway,
But
they go to the house.
And they crash a party.
Yeah, they crash a party. And they meet a little boy named Thomas.
And they essentially
spend the night...
drinking and partying with everyone to sneak upstairs to get into the clock. And the clock doesn't work.
Right.
And then they're like... Quentin's like, wait a second. You know, in the books, it's always like
a little kid.
Yeah. So he's like, we're just going to like...
We're going to glom onto this little kid. And they...
steal his little fillery trip. So they hang out with poor Thomas, who has a little rocket bed. And they're just playing, like, drunk off their asses
at this point.
Playing high seas.
Rev knows that board games are good.
Playing high seas. And I love the bit when they get to Fillory again. They're playing high seas, and they have to make, like, ocean noises and stuff. And they're making it, and Josh makes a seagull noise. And they're like, it's a seagull, you know, keep going. And then they keep making the seagull noise. And, like, we said it was a seagull. And Josh is like, that's not me. And then, like, the whole room changes back into Fillory. And then they're... in the ocean
on the rocket bed. Yeah.
And it's like they'd done it at last. They'd gotten back to Fillory, and then, like, you know, Julia's crying and Quentin's like arms out Titanic style, like happy. Poppy tries to swim.
Yeah.
Because she Poppy and Josh both didn't actually really want to come.
Yeah.
That's also something that's interesting that I really like, is that Poppy is very grounded. She's like, why would I want to live my life in a fantasy world? I already have a life here.
Right.
And Josh is like, yeah, my life's pretty good too. I'm rich. Like, why would I want to go there? But they finally make it back to Fillory, and they get picked up by the Muntjac. And
Quentin, like, we've been looking for you for a year.
Quentin isn't like, you know, he wasn't the captain, you know, but he was like in charge, sort of. But now it's Elliot, and he's like, he got stubble, and he's rugged, and he and Quentin hug, and he's like, where were you, you ridiculous, ridiculous man? And they immediately shift into flirting again, and it's wonderful and good. And
so the Muntjac have been looking for a year and a day.
Yeah.
And they find them, and they're like, all right, well, it's your adventure.
Yeah, but we've been on a quest. While you were gone, we got a quest, because all the questing beasts were like, you have to deal with this.
Yeah.
And he's like, turns out you were right. That tree was a quest. Yeah. And Quentin's like, fuck. Yeah. I ignored it.
Yes. And they find out that magic is getting turned off.
Well, that's like a little bit later.
Yeah, I know. But that's part of it. That's the thing that the animals are worrying about.
The thing about that is that magic is getting turned off because Julia and Free Trader Beowulf got the attention of the old gods. So it's really like, we're solving both of the problems, which is like Julia's trauma, but then also like the thing that she instigated when that triggered also what traumatized her.
Right.
But what happens is, like, you know, Elliot's really good at questing. He's like really good at it, and they've basically already found most of the keys except for two, and they've been going on this super awesome quest, and they've all bonded as like Bingle is teaching Benedict how to sword fight. Like, Benedict has a haircut; he's no longer has his emo hair. You know, everyone's like rugged and seaworthy and awesome, and they're like, yeah, like we saw like a train that came up out of the water and then went back again. I'm like, yes, Silver Arrow reference before it was a Silver Arrow reference.
That's right. Lev was writing about animated train, fantasy trains even before he knew it.
He just really like Spirited Away.
I guess, you know? He did.
And
there's all so types cool. of
there's
interesting...
like an island where like you can only tell the truth.
Yep. And there was it was like a castle that was just floating and nobody was in it. See, once again, like this is what he did great in the first book was these little one rapid off. Fire one-off, you know, oh, then there was this, and there was this, and there was this, and there was this,
so
and there was this,
cool.
And then it never gets mentioned again.
Like, Bingle, he's like, yeah, I got this super cool magical sword, and I had to trade some, like, my most prized thing to, like, get it, and they're like, what did you trade? And he's like, I won't say.
I'll never tell.
But it's
Bingle.
It's so good.
Where's the Adventures of Bingle book?
Well, there's good fan fiction about Bingle.
Is there?
There is. Right. I read it. But yeah, so Quentin and Josh and Poppy and Julia, they all join in on Elliot's quest to go find the seven golden keys. And that's where we like sort of hear the story and stuff about.
So there's it's a fairy tale and it's about
a knight
who he goes off, he leaves his family and goes to find these keys, and he keeps trading keys up. It's a bit like Rock Soup. Or Stone Soup, right?
Yeah.
Where it's kind of like, I'm going to trade you this for this. And people keep upgrading his key. And then he essentially...
He gets all of them.
He spends his whole life, essentially. He's an old man by the time he gets the final key. And he comes back home. And his daughter was...
Doesn't recognize him
Yeah,
anymore.
Well, the daughter was locked up. That's what he needed to get her out of the like a witch had locked her up. And so that's what the key needed to get her out. And by the time he gets back, he unlocks the door... And the daughter's all grown up, and she says, "Well, my dad wasn't old, you know. You're not my dad." And
and
she bails, and the
she
poor
was,
guy
like, captured by like a witch.
Yeah,
too.
By an evil witch, right? So the poor guy, the story ends with like the knight kind of going, "Well, now what?" And she gives the daughter gives him the key to the end of the world.
Yeah, she gives him the final key
to the end of the world, and so that's the quest. Is like we have to get the key to the end of the world. So they sail
the
on the mud.
Side
right.
Of the
so
world.
They sail to the Mudjack. They go farther than they've ever been on
the
map.
Yeah, they're 2 months out from Fillory, and this is like they're already past uncharted waters.
Right.
But Benedict has been charting as they go.
Right. And they get to this island.
They get to it,
and they're like, "This
they
is a pretty nice island.
This is nice. We should claim it for Fillory." And then Elliot's like, "That's a little imperialist."
Yeah.
And
they're like, "What to name it?" And they come up with a bunch of names,
but they don't have a name. And then
Ember shows up.
Yeah, Ember shows up. Who
and
has
lures
we haven't
Quentin.
Seen him since the no. He doesn't really lure him. He's
well,
just
he like trots up the hill.
Quentin's
and
like, why can't you just do the quest yourself? And Ember's like, well, there's some things that the gods can't do. Only men can do.
Right.
It's because it's like the deeper magic. You guys have to fulfill the
right,
quest.
Right, but to get to that
normal fantasy stuff.
But to get to that conversation,
they have a little stroll up
Quentin
the hill.
Ember just doesn't say anything and just trots up the hill
I mean,
to the
he's
top.
A mysterious guy.
And
what
then
are you even
Quentin
do,
keeps
following him.
And then finally they get
he
to the top.
He gets turned around.
And yeah, he gets all lost. And Ember tells him, well, you got to do this yourself. I can't help you.
Yeah, I can't help you.
And Quentin's like looking around and then Ember's
He's
gone.
He's like, oh, fuck, I'm lost.
Yeah, and so he starts. He tries to go back, but he loses his way. And he comes across a guy who is some sort of soldier, I guess, or guard.
Yeah.
And they get in a sword fight.
This I love this part because
sword fight's really good,
actually. Well, no, because before this, we don't really get. So, one of my favorite things from the first book is that, you know, Quentin gets this, like, wooden shoulder.
Right.
Because he gets violently munched on by the beast.
Martin, yeah.
And you don't really see it come back in play a lot. And then this is the moment where it finally like is mentioned again. It's because he gets sliced in the shoulder, but it catches him in his wooden shoulder, so he doesn't feel it. And so he takes
the sword.
Well,
the sword
gets
stuck in the shoulder.
He gets stuck in his shoulder, and it's awesome.
Well, but he also gets stabbed.
He's like, oh fuck, you know. He also gets stabbed. Yes,
and he's bleeding a lot.
But he fights. They fight, and then
he puts the guy to sleep. He knocks him out with a sleep spell, a fainting spell.
Yeah, and then and
although
like,
if I were Quentin, I would have killed him.
No.
Yeah, I would have. Like, no, you try to kill me.
This
I'd
is my
kill you.
Mother's least favorite part of the Magician King because, and I kind of agree. Quentin in the first book, when he watches the like ferret dude and grasshopper dude get like brutally murdered by Dint and Fen, he is like, "Wow, I never realized like how violent and bad actual murder is." Like, you know, because always in fantasy books, it's like no big deal, whatever. But it's actually really awful and terrible. And like, I think the whole time he can't really bring himself to like do violence. Like Anais is like, "Let's fucking go."
Well, but he's also been through that big fight in the tomb. Right?
Yeah, he
had been training under Bingle
sort
to learn how to sword fight. So he was like, "All right, let's go. I know how to sword fight now."
But I think it can be explained as like he was in the moment. He's like, "I'm the Magician King. I'm so strong and cool. I'm gonna fucking wreck their shit."
And then here comes another guard.
My mom hates it because Quentin's like, "Murder is bad." Proceeds to murder like 9 people.
And he doesn't murder anybody.
I know, it's just funny.
He
does maybe blow up.
No, he pummels. So then because now this is my favorite part of the book because it was chock full of action. And that is another guard comes after him and he buries that guy in a bunch of rocks or at least like knocks him out. He doesn't kill him. He just buries him in all his pebbles. And then he essentially is like bleeding and his shirt is ripped and he's grabbed his sword and he like flies up to the top of the castle and magic is crackling out of his purple magic. It's crackling out of his hands and the guards are like, "Oh crap, grab him." And he's shooting magic missiles at him and knocking him out. And this is my nomination for what the cover of The Magician's King should have been. Is it should have been Quentin with purple magic crackling out of his hand with a sword and the guards all kind of running as he's like storming the castle. And he gets to the castle
and then
he's starting to get surrounded, the Mudjack shows up and shoots cannons
and Julia's there
and
also like
Poppy shows up
and everybody's
chipping in and they fight and then they get to and then my other favorite part they get to the kind of the heart of the castle and there's this room and they open it up and this fireball launches out of Quentin and he was already using an anti-fire spell.
Yeah, he's got like wards up the ass.
Yeah, so he doesn't get burnt. And then there's like this lich there and I love liches. And the lich is like, "Well, that's all I got."
Yeah.
And he just kind of gives up and he says, "All right, here's the key."
Here's the key. And Quentin's like,
And then it turns out that the lich is actually the knight from the story. And he's like, "Yeah, that key with the gal.
Evil witch was my wife."
Yeah, the evil witch was my wife.
And my daughter, you know, just didn't.
My daughter bailed on me. Yeah. And I kind of have nothing left to live for. And he just drops dead.
Yeah, it's very sad.
It is sad, actually.
And then, this is the part that hurts, is Quentin triumphant. He's gotten the key. It's his quest, you know. They're getting out of the castle. They've done it. And they're going to celebrate. And then they get out on the beach. And they're like, "Wow, no casualties. It's great." And then who's there on the gangplank bleeding out? But
dead already.
He's dead.
It's Benedict.
He got shot in the throat.
Shot through the throat. He took one step off the boat.
And he got killed. Got killed.
And it's terrible.
It's really awful.
And it's a big downer. And everybody is all sad about
Quentin's
it.
Quentin's like, "Well, this quest sucks. This fucking sucks.
Yeah, screw quest."
And then afterwards, they name the island Benedict Island. Right. And then they sail away. And everyone's really, really sad because Benedict was kind of like, you know, the baby of the crew.
Right.
He was the young kid that everyone kind of, even if he was an ensemble kind of emo bitch, everyone loved
him.
No,
he eventually didn't get all emo. He grew up.
I know. And it's great. And, you know, poor Bingle's so sad.
Yes.
And so, like, Quentin, like, grief fucks Poppy, you know, which would have been coming for a bit. And then he's like, "Stay with me." And she's like, you know.
He's like, "All right, let's get you back home."
And
they use the key,
and then they end up in the Netherlands.
Poppy and him end up in the Netherlands,
and
which has been, like, hang on. The Netherlands is, like, still, we finally get to see it from, because Penny had described it, or somebody had described it as being destroyed. Josh, was it?
Yeah.
And so we finally see that, like, it's kind of messed up. And
it's frozen over.
Right, right. The water, the fountains are frozen over.
And it's because
magic is dying.
Yeah. And we get to see Penny again on his little Segway.
Yeah, so, no. His little hoverboard. He's not on a hoverboard. Floating like he's on a hoverboard.
A fish can dream.
But he has no hands. And he's awesome. Joined this order, mysterious order that takes care of the Netherlands.
Yeah,
and
it's the library.
And he's all chock full of magic power now because they've granted him all the knowledge of the universe.
He has, like, magic hands.
And now he's even more insufferable than normal. And so he says, all right, well, let me show you what's going on. And he essentially opens up a hatch in the Netherlands, and it shows that there's this god that's kind of essentially rerouting power.
It's like determinism.
But it's changing how things are working and essentially shutting things down. And Penny says, you know, if this doesn't get stopped somehow, all magic is going to go away and we're all screwed.
Yeah.
And those magic worlds will die. And so Quentin's like, well, I got to get back and I got to finish this quest because he realizes...
He's like, we'll let the library do it for you. And he's like, no.
Well, Penny tries to foist the library, the order on him. And Quentin says, no, this is my quest. I'm going to do it.
I'm going to end it.
And so they, what do they do? Go through the fountain again? I kind of remember.
I can check.
All right. Anyway, we don't need to thumb through the book.
We don't need to make sure.
So they end up back in Fillory again.
Yeah, they come back.
And they're like, we got to finish this quest.
Yeah. And so he's like, okay, well, maybe we can figure out... He goes and talks to Abigail, Sloth.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's been in the hold the whole time. She was actually... Like, she's the animal ambassador.
Right.
And we find out that they're like, oh, we thought you would be offended if we didn't come, and you guys thought that...
Yeah, they both were like, oh, we thought that.
Yeah,
you thought.
But Quentin goes to talk to Abigail.
Abigail essentially says...
I love the sloth lore. I need to talk about it. So,
oh, okay.
The lore about the sloths is that if a sloth is, like, living life so slowly... And is constantly sleeping, that basically they are the living bridge between life and death. And so Abigail knows how to get to the underworld. And so Quentin can go talk to Benedict. And he's like, I can go find out what happened. And she's like, yes, you can go find out what happened, but you also just, like, go talk to Benedict because I can imagine that, like, dying at such a young age is, like,
sucks.
That sucks, man. So Quinn's like, okay, what do I need to do? So she's like, okay, we're going to make a slide. And so they make a slide, they put it in the sand, and she's like, okay, get to the top of the slide, scooch down, and he slides down, and it doesn't work at first. And then he gets, like, sucked down into the sand, and he goes down a little swirly slide into the underworld, and it's one of those shitty tin ones, so he has to butt scooch a lot.
And he ends up down in the underworld.
And the person who's at the gate, this little kid, takes Quentin's passport from Eleanor that she made for him.
And no, he takes the passport from Quentin.
Yeah, that's what I said.
No, you said from Eleanor.
Eleanor made the passport
right.
for Quentin.
And so that gets him into the underworld.
Gets him into the underworld. So then,
and there's all these shades.
And Julia comes with him.
Right. And there's all these shades that are essentially playing ping pong and crappy
really
board
games.
And they're just like, it's kind of
they're
this
very
eternal
bored. They're all in
waiting,
pajamas.
This eternal waiting room.
Yeah.
And so Quentin
finds Benedict.
Right.
And talks to him. And he's like, hey, I wanted to see you. I just want you to know that, like, you didn't die in vain. You know, we got the key. But then Benedict's like, but no one else died. It was just me. And it's, like, useless. There's nothing to do down here. I hate it. I wish something would happen. It's so everything's boring.
Yeah.
Like, and he's just so apathetic and sad. His hair is back to the emo because he's, like, regressed in his character development, basically.
Well, Benedict says, though, that when Quentin had accidentally, him and Julia accidentally
had gone through the door, he had gotten the key, but he didn't
he
know
retrieved
who
the key.
How to tell anyone.
He didn't know
he got it.
Yeah, so he had hung on to it and he still had the key. And so he gives the key to Quentin, and Quentin's like, this is it. This is the last key.
And he's like, Benedict,
you're the hero.
You've done it. Like, you're the hero. Yeah. And it's really sad, though, because it just hurts, because I love Benedict.
Yeah.
It's so sad. And then, meanwhile, Julia is realizing that, like, her shade is gone, and that, you know, something has fundamentally changed about her. And then, because it's the Fillorian underworld, we see people who died in Fillory. So we see Fenn. And we see Martin Chatwin. Yep. And we also see Jollibee. But Martin Chatwin, like, they start, all the ghosts essentially start, all the shades start, like, you know, they know ganging something's up wrong, and they know something's up because Quentin's alive and they can tell. In that moment, they're like getting ready to rumble. Basically, Martin's a little 13-year-old little bitch ass little boy. And he's like, you want to fucking go? Like, your girlfriend isn't here, by the way, if you were looking for her. Ha ha. You know, because he's his garbage boy.
And then Julia essentially summons...
She starts to, like, transform.
Yeah.
And she finally kind of unlocks this part of herself that, like, has been slowly emerging the whole time.
Well, she realizes that, you know, even though she doesn't have a shade, that she can still grow past it and become this demigod.
Yeah, and so she grows huge, and she gets, like, a cool staff out of a hockey stick, and her eyes finally change color to, like, green instead of the black that they've been stuck with. And she's, like,
glowing.
She's glowing and magical, and she's huge and awesome, and she clears people out of the way.
And then the Our Lady of Underground shows up.
Our Lady of the Underground shows up, and she, like, claims Julia as one of her, like, daughters.
Which is interesting, because when they talked about the myth of this character, essentially it's kind of a Persephone-type character.
Yeah, and that she got tricked...
She got tricked to go into the underworld.
Yeah.
And so, and, you know, Our Lady Underground. And so it makes sense that she's essentially the queen of the underworld.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, Julia, my favorite, you know, come on, let's get you out of here.
Yeah. And so Julia and Quentin get lifted up out of the underworld.
Although
by
there is
OU.
A sad moment
that
where.
It is so sad because
Quentin
Benedict,
tries to grab Benedict and pull him out.
On because he was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to save Benedict. Yeah. I'm going to save him and it's gonna work out. But then he slips and
he falls and he isn't able to save Benedict.
That part made me cry so hard.
Yeah, it's very sad. And then, So they get back and
Quentin is back on.
All right. Stop reading through the book. This is lousy podcasting.
Shut up. I need to read the quote. They get back to the boat.
Your book is full of dog ears, and yet you didn't mark any of this stuff.
I probably have the scene marked. Here it is. So, my favorite bit from this is when Quentin comes back from the underworld. They're back on the ship, and he is just sitting and feeling all these emotions and feeling
he's so sad.
Like, but he's also feeling like the life of it and everything. And this is my favorite bit from The Magician King. Shut up! He says. He took a deep breath and sat up. Away from the warmth of the goddess's body, he shivered in the early morning ocean air. But even the cold felt good to him. This is life, he kept saying to himself. That was being dead, and this is being alive. That was death. This is life. I will never confuse them again. It's just, it's so good. It's so good! He's finally, this is, like, from moment one of the first book. I always say this, but the Magician Trilogy is a 3-book character arc for Quentin. And he is just constantly learning how to live and how to, you know, actually, like, instead of just surviving in his life, actually live his life and become hopeful for the future and, you know, move forward. And that's, like, one of the big moving forward moments is the... like incredible contrast of being dead is being apathetic and, you know, being like self-centered and, you know, stuck in this kind of determining sort of
gray world
where nothing matters and you can't do anything. And then
he realizes that life is important. Yeah, that's a good lesson. Now we'll see how Lev screws it up in the third book.
Okay, Dad. But yeah,
all right,
they
so they get back and they have to travel to the end of the world, and they essentially, the boat, this is very sad, the boat, as the water becomes more shallow, the boat keeps dropping parts of itself off so that way the boat can still sail. And eventually this big, like, gorgeous galleon becomes this little raft, and it's because it's dropped off all these bits so they can sail. And then they literally, the poor boat just, like, falls apart, and they have to walk the rest of, like, the water is so shallow that they have to walk the rest of the way to the edge of the world.
Well, it's also, this is again like Narnia, but it's like Narnia, but in the sense that, like, when they get to the edge of the world in Dawn Treader, what happens is that, like,
wait, they rip that off? Is he just ripping off Narnia again?
The whole thing is Dawn Treader, like, fucking inspired. It's so obvious.
I haven't read Dawn Treader.
But in Dawn Treader, what happens is that when they get closer to the edge of the world, everything gets brighter and brighter, and the water gets clearer and more blue, and you get all these white flowers that start to show up. And the water also does get, like, shallower as well. And then they, like, reach a sandbank.
All right. Well, and here they reach a wall.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's like a wall at the edge of the world.
It's the same wall that was in the underworld, too.
Oh, really?
It's described as, like, it's the same. It looks the same. Right. And there's two chairs, and it's Elaine, and it's the lich dude from before, because Elaine is...
Oh, was that the lich guy?
Yeah.
Oh.
Elaine is the daughter of
I thought that
guy.
Was just some other guy.
No.
All right. It's... All right, anyway, they're the guardians of this door. The door has 7 keyholes in it, which would
they
have made a great
Quentin
cover for the book.
He puts them in.
And they're like, well, what I like that moment is where he says, hey, do you guys want to do this?
And
like, Elliot's like, no, it's your quest. You got to finish it.
Well,
and
also, Elliot's yearning at all times. All right.
So they unlock the key. They have a tough time getting all the locks, and they open it up, and then they're like, all right, well, what's beyond it?
And it's the far side.
And they were like, well, it's the far side. And I was like, oh, what, the cartoon? Famous cartoon? But no, it's like, it's kind of this reverse world.
It's underneath Fillory.
It's Australia, I guess. So
Poppy's like,
so,
my people.
So they were like, well, do you want to go through the door? And Bingle's like, well, I'm not supposed to ever return from here, so yeah, I'll do it. And him and Abigail... go in and whoop, off they go into off into the world.
Where's
and,
my spin-off
and,
story?
Yeah, exactly.
Where's my short story?
Yeah. Well, let's have a whole story. I'm sure there's a whole big adventure. Bingle and
Julia,
Abigail.
Julia has become a demigod. She's become a dryad.
Yeah, and she's like, my tree is in there.
My tree is on the far side. I can sense it, but she can't go through.
They're like, we're not going to let you through because...
Because you caused the mess in the first place.
Right. And Quentin is like...
That's unfair.
Yeah, well, he was going to go in... And they're like, well, you don't have a passport. And he's like, well, I used my passport to get into the underworld. And they're like, yeah, but you don't have one now, so you're screwed. And so, but then Quentin, what does he do? He, like, talks.
He talks to them and he says, well, hey, that's unfair that you would, she's suffered so much.
Right.
And she's more than, like, atoned for the issue. She's paid for the problem that she caused.
Right.
And he's like, that's completely unfair that you would do that. So, how about I take on all of Julia's, like...
Sins.
Like, her the blame for what happened. Like, I will take the responsibility for all the shit that happened to her if you let her through.
And they were like, okay.
They're like, cool, fine, whatever.
So Julia goes through, and she, like, flies off to go find her tree.
Yeah.
And then...
Ember
comes Ember, and Ember goes, hey, Quentin.
Yeah, he's like, wow, good job.
Good job,
you.
Yeah, you're awesome. Now get the hell out of
the This is also the part that made me sob profusely.
Sad.
This whole chapter.
It's so sad.
So this is essentially what happens to the kids at the end of the Narnia books.
Happens to them at the end of every book in Narnia.
Yeah.
That didn't happen in the first book.
It did.
He didn't have a moment where Ember shows up and goes,
no,
you're
not
out.
Not there. I won't say. But
yeah, first
this
book.
Whole,
we already talked about
it. This part I do love because you have like the slow realization of what's happening in Quentin's point of view. And he's like, oh no.
And everyone else is
like, what? Oh no. Like, but they don't know what to do.
Right. Yeah, they're helpless.
They're helpless to stop it. And poor Elliot also realizes, he starts crying.
Yeah.
And it's so upsetting. And Quinn is like, no, you can't do this because I was the hero of this quest. Like,
and they're like, yeah, if you want to be the hero, you got to take the responsibility.
Yeah, if you're the hero, what does the hero do? The hero loses. The hero loses things.
Yeah.
And so that's what happens to Quentin is he loses his ability to stay in Fillory. He gets kicked out. And so Julia gives him a little kissy. And then she leaves.
Poppy and Josh are off to become, they're going to assume the throne.
Yeah.
Oh, they're also, Ember also says, yeah, you no longer can be the king anymore.
Can't be the king because you're getting kicked out. But then Elliot gives Quentin a passionate kiss. Shut up and let me talk about this. It's great. We love Elliot Watt. Yearning gay man. It's
Elliot,
wonderful.
Who's not like barely
but,
in this book.
But he's like, here, let me. I was saving this for you. I found it and I got it for you at the beginning, like, you know, the year ago when Quentin disappeared. He's like, I saved this for you. And it's this pocket watch from one of the clock trees.
Yeah.
And he gives it to Quentin and he's like, here. And he's like, cool, we'll find a way back. We'll bring you back, you know. And also, Elliot does like argue with Ember as well to like try and figure it out. But then he's like, it's the way it is.
Yeah, you know? You can't.
And he's like, I can't leave. I have to stay with Fillory.
Yeah, he's the High King.
I'm the High King. I have to deal with this. And it's so sad. And then Quentin gets kicked out and he is in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And, but I will say, is very sad. He's really depressed. And he's like, well, I'm not king anymore. I guess I'll just go back to Earth and, you know, and also the dragons, you know, did a whole thing.
What do you mean, a dragon?
Never mind, that's from book three. I forgot. All
right, stop spoiling stuff.
But
yeah, essentially just ends with Quentin all sad and ends up back on Earth.
But there's one thing.
Well, he looks at the grass.
Yeah, he looks at, the Netherlands, and the Netherlands is finally thawing.
Yeah.
And this is where the Netherlands is thawing and the grass is growing and stuff is growing in the fountains.
Right.
For the first time ever.
In a while.
No, for the first time.
Ever?
Because in the Netherlands before, it was just like dry and stuff. No. But this is the first time living things are like growing there.
Well,
and that's kind of like
the
nugget,
back,
the nugget of hope at the end of this book.
Nah, still a fucking downer ending.
No, but I really like that because Levis said, he was like, I wanted to include the Wood Between the Worlds, which is from Narnia, as the Netherlands, but he couldn't because it was copyright. So instead, the sprouts and stuff, it's implied that like the Netherlands is what the Wood Between the Worlds was either before or afterwards. So either the Netherlands was built on top of the Wood of the Worlds or it's what it was before.
Okay.
And that's what I really love, is that like, yes, the Narnia universe is connected. It's all connected.
Alright. So
it's really good.
So what was your rating of this?
Are we rating the book?
Oh, I don't know. Did we rate the book before?
I don't think we did, but all right. I mean, we can.
I think it's, I mean, it...
Well, did you, overall, did you like the book?
Yes, I did. I think I might have liked it a little bit more than the first one,
mm-hmm.
because of a little, it was a little bit more adventure-y. And it was interesting to see the way see more about the way the magic world was constructed. You know, it was more world building, a lot more interesting little characters, but still, I really think that he should do some offshoot, right? Like, it would be nice if he did some short stories or something to kind of fill in a lot more, because there's a lot of kind of areas left unwritten.
Fan fiction fodder.
No, just let him do it, though. I mean, I want it from the... If he's still alive, right? I mean, you know, if the...
Love is alive!
Yeah, but I'm saying that if the person who created it is still alive, they should be the ones to write it, right? I mean, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's just done with Fillory and... And
he's,
you know, burnt out. Yeah, but yeah, I know. He's got a new love.
He's got a new
movie.
It
looks like a train. But I think that he's got to have something, right? He's got to have like notes or something that he's created, you know, about world building that maybe he could eventually write, like just write a book of a few short stories or something. I think
are short stories included in different publications.
In where?
It depends. There's like
written by him.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
They're like sections of like either cut chapters or stuff like that.
Okay.
Like I know there's a Magician King one. There's
right, but edited material is different than like an actual, like, hey, I'm going to write the story about Bingle and how he got his magic sword. Or I'm going to write the story of the adventures of Elliot and the crew of the Mudjack.
The adventures of Bingle and Abigail.
Well, you just want, you just all Bingle all the time.
I like Bingle. He's cool.
Yeah, he is cool. Yeah, so there's a lot of still world building I think Lev could do. And stories to tell.
This book
which
was published 10 years
ago. Yeah, I know. It was published 10 years ago. So what the hell? Where's the another material, right? Get to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's good. I mean, you know, but more importantly, your mother always has good taste in books.
Mm-hmm.
So I shouldn't doubt it, you know. But yeah, it was enjoyable, but it was sad. It was, you know, prepare yourself for
sad.
A sad ending. I mean, if you've gone through this whole thing already, we've already just ruined it all for you anyway. But yeah, I think it's worth reading. Lev is a good writer. He writes good action. He writes good dialogue. He writes interesting scenarios. I think it's worth your time.
Yeah. I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, but The Magician King is like my second favorite of the Magician's trilogy. My preference goes 3-2-1. But it's definitely my favorite in terms of like... locations and stuff is, you know, we get to see all these cool different places. I love the underworld scene. Chapter 24 is my favorite section of this book. It makes me cry. This whole book made me cry when I read it. I just enjoy it. I also really like I like the beginning when they're in Fillory and they're just ruling and we get to hear about how they basically do nothing except for wave at people because they don't have much to do. And it's just really sweet. And also, I like that Elliot's like, yeah, I love Janet in charge of the throne. She's probably gonna, like, go to war with some, like, lawyer or something when we get back. But, you know, it's whatever. It's fine. She's gonna become a dictator. It's fine.
Yeah, so we'll see. I love Janet. So do we get to see what happens?
Well, you'll have to read The Magician's Land. Find out.
All right. I guess I'll have to read The Magician's
Land. You have to wait a while, though.
Why do I have to wait a while?
Because we have to wait in between.
No, we don't have to wait. We do. Don't make me wait. Stop it. All right. Anyway, well, that's it for The Magician King. Yeah. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. Special episode.
And we will... What?
Well...
I mean, the next will be the...
Season three.
The Magician Land?
Season three,
episode yes.
Episode one.
Yes. So thanks for listening. And yeah, we might be back for more The Magicians.
Yeah. And there might be a break. Might not. We'll figure it out. By the time this comes out, we'll probably know if we're taking a break in between season two and three.
That's okay. Just keep listening or listening. Listen to the old stuff to refresh,
to the
your,
old ones,
refresh
you know.
Your memory. All right. Well, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening.
And we'll see you.
You'll hear us.
I don't know. We need a better sign off. What? Some sort of we'll see you in out. Fillery.
No.
All right. Bye.